This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company. Learn more at hotdishproductions.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're turning an eye to food at its trickiest, from imitation olive oil to the pretensions of 3D printers.
We were just doing like a birthday party for one of the employees, and we printed a steak just for fun.
You know, a grape Jolly Rancher isn't going to satisfy your craving for grapes. So, I mean, in a sense, it kind of multiplies the sensory qualities that we can love in the world.
So basically, you culture the cell in a bioreactor, it grows, and then ultimately, at the end, you come out with a piece of meat.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief, with your hosts, me, Zara Tangora, and
me, your mom, Bobby Conforto.
You nut. Are you adorable or what? I think the answer is absolutely. Bobby, hello. It's very nice to see your smiling face this morning.
Hi, Saz, you too.
How's it going? What's new?
It's Friday. And it's my day to unwind a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to some nature. And I'm going to come to Brooklyn and take a walk with you by the Brooklyn Bridge Park. I'm looking forward to that.
So today we welcome teacher, writer, poet, Beth Robbins. What an incredible talk with Beth. Beth was very special. Cool person.
She's like a guide through the underworld with an unbelievable spirit and joy about her.
Yeah, she's really just a very intelligent, very well-read, very heartfelt, genuine, cool, dynamic human. And
smart. I learned about metaphors and poetry and lots of things. She brought so much of herself to her story.
She did. And it was interesting because I was like, while we were doing the show, and I believe I even said this, I was like, I feel like I learned so much. And then I realized I always learn so much. Each one of our guests has something. Mm-hmm. I always walk away from the show being like, oh, I just feel smarter having been in that person's mm-hmm. presence with their wisdom and their experience. And Beth
smarter
was
and
no
richer.
Different.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really, really a wonderful person. It was a great mm-hmm. talk. And Beth is in the Berkshires, where we've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time in our lives together. And so that was another special connection.
Made it very special. And I feel, you know, thinking, I always think about how the shows are going to help different people that I know. And I'm really, this is good timing because I'm about to start a group with, young women that have lost their spouses and they have children. And I just feel like Beth is going to be very inspirational and helpful to them.
Cool. That's great. That's great. Synchronicity. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, without further ado, we hope that you all have a wonderful weekend. You're hearing this a week later. Bobby, good luck with your drinking fest. I know you probably have a frat party to get to. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow for a walk. How fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's spring, guys. Spring is here for all of us, no matter what state we're in.
Spring
is here. Yep.
I find spring to be difficult, to be completely honest mm-hmm. with you. I find it to be there for a variety of reasons. Number one being my allergies. Number two, it's a transitional time. And as are all, if you're in a place that experiences seasonal weather and seasons, you know, seasons can be really transitional. There's something about spring. I don't know. It's like, I like it. And then I also feel very vulnerable in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Well, so are the little sprouts growing.
Yeah, and like little baby animals.
They're vulnerable too.
Exactly.
Everybody's very vulnerable.
It's a very
good way of putting
it.
Yeah. Yep.
Do I look like a baby animal?
A little baby bunny.
What about now?
Yeah, baby bunnies are.
I feel like an adorable baby animal. And I don't like it. No, but spring is, it's interesting. I tend to really love, I love summer. I'm a summer person. I love the like intensity of the summer, the like unabashed intensity, the hot weather and the juicy fruits and vegetables and zesty spicy peppers. But like spring is also quite intense, but in a way where it appears not to be.
I think you pinned it, Zara. I think there's a vulnerability in spring.
Yeah.
And vulnerability is both curious, amazing, and somewhat threatening. So I think you made a very good metaphor when you said that. And just going outside and seeing everything so new, how it breaks through the earth. It's amazing how these little shoots push through the earth.
Yeah.
We could barely dig the earth and it can shoot right through. And they're all very vulnerable because who knows what happens to them, you know? So it was a good point. So I love you and all our guests.
Oh, I see how it is. You want to get off the phone with me already. Shooing me off. Now she's mouthing to me. She's doing cut it out. Okay, Bobby, I love you. I'll talk to you later.
Bye, guys. Enjoy the show.
Enjoy our talk with Beth.
Bye.
Guys, so today we are joined by Beth Robbins. Beth is a high school English and drama teacher and also a writer and poet. And Beth, we can add actress to that list of credits, correct? I saw you yesterday in a movie and it was great.
That's true. Amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, thank you. So, I mean, I guess we could even just pop right off with that. How did you become even interested in acting? I mean, we're going to get into your story in a minute, but had acting been something you had been interested in before? Because you were so natural and so great in the film.
I had always wanted to be an actress when I was growing up. I had also wanted to be a writer. And that's, two of the huge ironies in the surprising gifts of after Steve's death are that I've actually done both now. I didn't think I was good enough to be an actress. And so I took a different path. And then I was invited to do this short fictional film version of my life, or this sort of this a fictional version of it in the year following Steve's death. I became friendly with Cynthia Wade, who directed the movie.
It might be a play someday.
Yeah. Well, it was amazing, actually. I don't know. I think the thing about grief is that it's, for me, it's always right there. And so I'm able to access it. So I was definitely acting in the movie, but I was also able to access what's always right there. And and I loved it. I mean, I loved it.
You were great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sproutland. is the name of the short film.
That's correct.
And we'll get into why and what it was about in a minute. But actually, I want to just ask a quick question, which is that in your questionnaire that you filled out, you mentioned that you are originally from Long Island. We are from Long Island as well. We have three Islanders here. Where are you from in Long Island?
I grew up in Merrick.
Okay, cool.
Where are you from?
Huntington, Northport area.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of bounced between the two. But I don't know. I had this thought about Long Island. And then you went to school in the city. Did you go to college in the city?
Yeah, I went to Barnard.
Okay, awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have this theory about places like Long Island, but Long Island could be anywhere, any suburb, but that's like somewhat adjacent to a large city, like in this case, New York City, that, you know, I don't know. It sparks it's like the city is so close. You kind of see it.
Right.
And either you're like repelled by it or you're like drawn to it. You know what I mean? And I have this just kind of theory, I don't know, just about something being in that Long Island tap water other than lead that actually makes people really creative. I know so many creative, interesting people from Long Island. So I just thought it was cool to know that we shared a home, a home place. Yeah. So then you went to college and you in college met who would be your husband, correct?
Right. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. And how did you guys meet? I think it's a pretty cute and interesting story and kind of informed what seems to be the rest of, you know, the next couple decades of your relationship. You guys met.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I went to a lecture in college on Gandhi. And I became very inspired by the professor. His name was Dennis Dalton. And I decided that I had to become a vegetarian. And this was in the early 80s, and it was a different world in terms of ability to get food if you were eating in that kind of a way. And I didn't know what to eat. And so a friend of mine, Alicia, who I give a shout out in the book that I wrote, she was very into, it was New Age and vegetarian lifestyle. And she said that this guy named Sprout Man was giving courses in his apartment on Riverside Drive, and he was looking for someone to work for him. And this was data entry, or actually it wasn't even data entry, it was typing on labels. So this was a long time ago. And I went to his house, his apartment rather, and worked for him, and he basically fed me. We saw each other. It sounds like this romantic thing, but we were not interested in each other because we were very different. I was very into goth, and I was with my Doc Martens and my black clothing and cutoff shorts. And he was like all very pink and gauzy and crystals and sandals. And his apartment was very light and joyful. And I loved Russian literature and coffee and wine and things. Anyway, he welcomed me into his apartment, and we became very, very, very good friends. And he did feed me, basically. He taught me. And he did that for the entirety of our relationship. So,
what kind of things did he feed you then? What do you remember?
I remember exactly what he fed. He was sprouting everything. And he really was a groundbreaking person in his time. He was a pioneer of that movement, inspired by Victorious Kolvinskis and Ann Wigmore, wheatgrass and things. And so he had all kinds of sprouts in his apartment, and he made the most amazing things, which I still miss some of it. I mean, he didn't make it for decades, honestly, but there was cashew cheese, which was really not cheese at all. It was just sprouted, I don't know, soaked cashews, and and he dehydrated it or something. But every day there were these huge salads. And so one of the benefits of my job is that I'd be sitting and typing labels, and they'd say, okay, let's have lunch. And he'd have these wooden bowls, and he'd make these beautiful sprout salads. And then he'd make tahini dressing. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Yeah.
It's beautiful. And also I'm struck by the unavoidable, in my mind at least, metaphor of sprouts, right? New beginnings, and of this also a sprout is something that we can so often just cast aside, right? Like you have a lentil or a bean or a rye berry or a cashew, you know, things that can be sprouted, and we almost never do. It seems to me to be so poignant that Steve was someone who took the time to find the most you could get out of a single item, and that's actually the most healthy and rich part of it, right?
Right. I mean, that's the moment when everything is ready to explode with, it has the potential to explode with, in a positive sense, with all the nutrition. So
so interested in sprouts? Like what would I'm so interested to know, because it's so specific and it's so awesome, but to be so interested in sprouts, that's like, I'm curious about his kind of origin story as well.
He had suffered from allergies. He grew up in the Bronx, and he had tremendous problem with allergies. He was an asthmatic. And through whatever his journey was exactly, he discovered raw foods, and he decided to do a fast. And he started off by fasting, and he did an extremely long fast. I mean, he was very, to use the word extreme again, he was very extreme. He did a 100-day fast, a juice fast. It wasn't that he was starving. But he did a lot of cleansing, and he healed himself. Basically, he took care of his allergies. He took care of his asthma, And he became a tremendous proponent of this. And he was, I mean, someone who would call them or would go by the name of Sprout Man. He was designated that by Vegetarian Times in 79. But he took that moniker on and made it his own. He was a real character in the best sense of the word. He was an entertainer. He had been doing these sort of vaudeville kind of shows. He played piano and cool. he wrote songs and skits and things. And he, as he started on this journey toward health, he integrated the character of Sproutman into his show. And so for a while, this is before I met him, he said he had both things going on. And then he just decided to leave the performing and become just the Sproutman. But it was still a it was authentic. It wasn't a performance that he wasn't living the life, but he was a lecturer and taught classes. And so.
And did it become a business? Was it something that he also sold and monetarily?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the city, he had the classes in his apartment. It was called the Sprout House. And then when he and I met in the early 80s, and then we got married in, 86. But in 85, our building was going co-op on the Upper West Side, and we decided to move out of the city. That's when we moved up to the Berkshires, which is where I live now. And so he made a shift. He had written a lot of books at this point, or pamphlets is really what they were. And he shifted to an online business, and the business is called Sproutman now. And our sons run that business. It's sprouting seeds, sprouters, and all kind, anything having to do with sprouts and healthy living, juicers and whatnot.
So awesome.
Yeah, it became a business. It sustained us, for the years that he was alive. And then our sons took it over, and now they've sort of rebranded it and relaunched it in a slightly different way. But it's sproutman.com, and it's definitely there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Incredible. So, you know, we've been talking a lot around Steve in the past tense, and you mentioned right off the bat that he passed. Can you tell us the story about Steve's passing?
Yeah. So in 2015, September 9th, he went to a business meeting in Connecticut, and was in a car accident on his way home. It was a head-on collision, and he died instantly. And so that's what that was.
Oof. Yeah. That is so intense. You know, in reading your book, which was absolutely beautiful, called A Grief Sublime. Just a poetic, your book is a mixture of poetry and you know, narrative kind of nonfiction. But in reading your book, I was really struck by, in the beginning parts of it, the shock element associated with when someone dies like that. And, you know, being like, there was a part of the book where you were like, but just this morning we were talking about, you know, so-and-so, and our son was going to school and eating breakfast. And it's such an interesting thing. I think a lot of people who have experienced sudden loss and trauma, that you're like, but your brain is catching up. You're like, but today was started like this. Like, how could this be this now? It doesn't, it takes so long, which I think anyone who hasn't experienced it, it's hard to relate to, and being like, the quote unquote kind of surrealism to it is so true. And you captured that so beautifully in your book. I really appreciated that and made it so tangible.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that experience of the suddenness?
I'm just trying to think of how to get into it. So what happened was, he just didn't come home. That's the simplest way to put it. And so for hours I was waiting for him. I didn't know where he was. And it was very not his way to be out of communication. And so he was many, many hours late. I was alone in the house. And then a police car pulled into the driveway. And I wrote about this moment because it was so, it was really extraordinary to think about it after the fact. And it reminded me of a bit that I had read from Joan Didion's book, A Year of Magical Thinking, where when I saw the police arrive, I knew he was dead. I knew that he was dead. And I decided that I wouldn't open the door. And so if I didn't open the door, then it wouldn't be real. I could just leave it outside. And it's such a, it's a very, very strong memory, that experience of not wanting to open the door. But as soon as they told me, it was really became an out of body experience. And I saw myself, from outside myself, and, I didn't know where to sit. So there's this, because this is right. This is just, it was ordinary life. There was no preparation, right? I was expecting him home. Mm-hmm. And they asked, who do you want to call? And of course I wanted to call him. Mm-hmm. He was the one I wanted to call. So it was just absolute confusion. I didn't scream. I didn't howl. I mean, maybe some people probably do. You see that a lot in movies. It was really just more of this. I just sort of left my body in a way. Yeah.
Which is what we do in trauma. You know, in trauma, right. It's too more than we can handle. So we, it's almost like our spirit has to, our psyche has to just like leave so that we can.
Right.
Maybe we're processing up there. I don't know. But no way you can stay right here.
Right. That's correct. You need to observe.
Not acceptable.
I'm just kind of just struck by the literal not wanting to open the door, and then also the metaphor for that in terms of like even continuing grief, right? And I feel like in some ways the grieving process and healing process is a lifelong relationship with opening being able to open the door.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And I think there are so many times in which we're like, we open it and then we like shut it again, and we open it and sometimes it stays open forever. And so, you know, it's, but I just, when you said that, I was like, wow, this is such a kind of, you know, it didn't necessarily open for real forever, right? When you opened it that night.
Yeah. Right. That's correct. I mean, that's what I was alluding to earlier about the film, which was also a whole other crazy experience to be able to have to play myself, but a fictional version. So it was acting, but it was accessing a real emotion. And that's what I mean about it always being there. It's never, the reality of his death is always present. It's very present. I find that it's 5 years on, I just have more of a capacity to negotiate the situation. So I'm not overwhelmed by it as I was in the early days, where it would like these tidal waves, a feeling of drowning and panic attacks and all of the other things that I was experiencing. Also,
though, call that, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's all right.
No, I was just going to say, I always call that turtle medicine. You know, that ability to go in your shell, and when you're ready to stick your head out, you do.
Right.
And that shell is so important. And in many ways, that's a denial of it even happening. That's, I mean, there was a movie once about a woman who suddenly lost her husband. And for a year, she did not go through that door. And it's okay. It's really okay. Yeah. We do what we need to do to survive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I didn't mean to interrupt you before.
No. That's all right. I was just going to say that the thing that I found enormously helpful, you didn't ask this question exactly, but having children that I was conscious of and caring for, and also the fact that I was a teacher, and decided to go back to teaching 3 weeks after he died. It was an ability to, the grief was always there, but I could set it aside and do what I needed to do. And then I knew that it was there. And I wrote about this, and this was the real experience, sobbing in the car, then stopping when I got to school, washing my face in the bathroom at the school, and then moving on, out to teach. But also just being present for our children, was a whole other thing. So.
It was something else that I was so taken by in your writing, and it had to do with that inner world that you created to grieve. Uh-huh. So what you're describing is I had to be in the external world. I had to teach and I had to take care of my kids and function in my household. Mm-hmm. But the depth of your inner world and how you got there and what that meant to you and how you describe it is absolutely profound, really.
Huh. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
And I think that's... Oh, sorry, Beth. I was going to mention that, you know, talking about the inner world, right? That's the one we have to live in all the time, 24/7, mm-hmm. right? So finding mm-hmm. a way to make that palatable, livable, habitable. Habitable? No, that's not right. Habitable? Habitable.
There you go.
Is the way, but yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mentioned this also in the book, which is sort of like a metafiction moment where this friend of mine had said, you should be journaling. It doesn't matter what you write, she said, just write something. And so about a week after he died, I think is when I started writing, and I just wrote everything. I think that's what you're speaking about, Bobby. I mean, that was the beginning of it. It was creating a dialogue with myself. Also speaking very much to Steve, and then developing an ability to listen to myself, to my own needs, listen to what was going on around me. I had amazing dreams, which I wrote down and was able to, thank God, the gift of a computer is that you like, I had written, I don't know why I did this, or dream. And then I wrote my dream on my document. And yeah. then when I was writing the book, I just searched for dream.
Great.
And so that was, so yeah, everything was there. But the other thing was poetry, the gift of poetry, which I've always been a passionate reader, and I'm an English teacher with a tremendous passion, especially for the 19th century poets, but the Romantics most especially. And I found them providing a lifeline in a way that was extraordinary. I had always had an intellectual or an aesthetic appreciation for what they had done. John mm-hmm. Keats was always a favorite of mine, or has been for a long time. But it was more, it was really, it was a lifeline. Because they're writing about things that they're addressing things in a way that this doesn't have an answer, right? The horror of Steve's death. I'm not looking to justify it, find the reason or anything else. I just have to live with it. It's not something that I can integrate necessarily in a way that it disappears for me. And that's what poetry does for me. It also just allows you to be in that place of unknowing.
Right. Yeah. It always reminds me, too, that throughout the centuries, throughout lifetime, our humanity, we have loss and we have trauma and we
right.
have this unbelievable struggle. I always love Rumi, and I quote Rumi uh-huh. all the time to help people see. I mean, we've all dealt with this. This is our common humanity.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm in my worst kind of times, I always go to the Met and I go to the Egyptian wing and realize that like grief and death and dying and ritual has been happening for thousands and thousands. There's something about, just to your point, right. about attaching to like the history mm-hmm. and the commonality in that, that I think is really important. I was just listening to an upcoming guest talking yesterday on her radio show about suicide, death by suicide being lower during the pandemic. And she hypothesized, I think pretty accurately, that it's because of the common shared grief that everyone was experiencing and the like less aloneness, right? Uh-huh. And so I think that in that, the message kind of is basically what we're talking about is finding something to attach to that's part of something greater. And like, you know, the great poets of our time and mm-hmm. times way before, I mean, I don't know if this is what you mean, but I think this is what I'm getting from what you're saying about attaching to poetry. And I think we all might get this in different ways, is just finding like a common bond in, mm-hmm. you know, in not just grieving, but in living, in the fact that like life and right. like all of the things that happen within a life are not singular. And I think right. that's comforting. Is that at all?
Yeah.
On the same vein of what you're kind of saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And specifically, and because I love to refer to Keats, his Ode to a Nightingale, I referred to this in the book, but the lines, though the dull brain perplexes and retards, already with thee. Those lines from one of his stanzas became a mantra for me. And I just, this idea that I'm with Steve, I'm already with him, and looking for him outside, I'm not going to find him. And trying to intellectualize it is not going to bring me any closer. It's really just, I feel it like it's a physical thing, but it's just sort of sitting back and being with what is. And not trying so hard to grab it, because he's not there anymore. He's not outside of myself. He's not outside. Exactly. It doesn't make the grief go away, because it's a profound grief, which I still,
But it answers something. It answers that question, how could somebody be here one moment and then be completely gone the next? It's not true. They're in us. Mm-hmm. So what I was so taken by your work, it's the concept of the presence and the absence. And I would love for you to talk more about that, because you described it in with such poetry and such beauty. And I work with 50 people a week who have had losses. It's what I do for my work. And this is the thing that helps us, because otherwise it's terrifying. It's the thought, how could it be that they're gone? And people struggle with this all the time. But I think in going into your abyss, into your depths, as you described, you seem to have found many ways. You even talked about, which I want to talk about later, which is how I know Steve is near. I loved that list that you made. It was amazing. So really, could you beautiful. Tell us more about that?
The presence and absence. Yeah. See, it's not an intellectual place that brings me to that, So he's absent. He's not here. I'm aware of that, but he's very present in when I'm, yeah. See, I'm like, well, I wrote it,
but it's okay. No, it's in you.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to think. So it's really, I don't know if I'm repeating what I said, but it's the presence is in sometimes these, I would get these energetic, rushes. It's like, I felt electrified or filled with incredible joy. And that made me think of Steve. Or, the funny ones were, I never liked, wheatgrass juice, for example. It's really healthy for you, but I found it just absolutely something I could not drink. And after he died, I loved it. And as soon as I drank it, one of our sons made me a glass. I said, can I have that? And I drank it and I felt Steve. I just felt Steve. Or going out for a walk in the woods, which is also something I didn't do. Even though we live in the beautiful the hills of Western Mass, but I felt compelled to go out in nature. And when I was in nature, listening, to the sounds and seeing the sights and smelling everything, I felt Steve. So yeah, it's. And then these lines of poetry, and it wasn't that was his thing, but the lines of poetry were allowing me also to access him in some way. And also, I think the biggest thing for me, and I forget to say this sometimes when I speak about it, but it's so essential, is the feeling of gratitude. The gratitude for having been with him for over 30 years, doesn't take away the pain of losing him earlier than I would have wanted to, but the gratitude is a real thing. It's like a landscape that I can walk on, and also just letting whatever images come up, letting me live with them. So dreams became very important. And I wrote about this feeling of sort of looking forward to sleep, because I felt myself with him and I was having incredible visions. very much visions. It's funny. I kept thinking of William Blake. He did all these amazing etchings and things. And I was seeing things that he had drawn. And I thought, this is wild. But is that kind of what you were?
It is. Well, you had a list of 15 things. Do you want me to read them?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
I'd love to, because I was so taken by this, because I'm so often talking with people about trying at some point to recognize what is instead of what isn't. And you had another way of putting that, but it was quite beautiful. You know, it's when we're grieving, we often see the emptiness and keep focusing on the void. And what you're describing is this richness inside where you didn't feel the void. You know,
right.
So.
Right.
Should I read it, your list?
Yes, please. Yes.
So this, how I know Steve is near. Number one, a gentle pressure or sometimes a slight tingling inside my head on the right side. Number two, I feel an energy surge. Sometimes I even have to move, dancing around. Number three, I hear a song in my head. And then when I play the song, my whole body agrees. Sometimes I dance then too. Four, I hear a song and I close my eyes. Love is here to stay. They can't take that away from me. Come rain or come shine, I feel Steve. Five, a palpable, visceral sense of joy comes over me. Total ecstasy. The same joy I felt at the funeral. I understand that. Six, I see a red tail talk, which you speak of a lot. Seven, I see a crow. I see butterflies, usually monarchs. Nine, I feel compelled to look up at the sky. Look up, bud. That's what I hear. Look up and out. 10. I feel a wave of despair, and right then a friend calls. 11. I see colors that move and morph and dance, whether my eyes are opened or closed, golden, green, sometimes rose red. 12. I discover a sudden, unexpected like for fresh green juices when I drink. I feel a burst of Steve. 13. I sprout peas and alfalfa, radish, broccoli for the first time, and I hear, yay, bud. I guess that's what he called you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 14. I feel beautiful. 15. During Savasana, I'm sorry, I'm pronouncing that wrong. I experienced what I imagined Steve felt when he left his body, a floating sensation, a weightlessness, a freedom. And I imagine you could have 15 more and 15 more after that. But
that's, yeah.
What's so important to help people, that's why I feel your book, I'm going to recommend it to so many of the people that I work
thank
with.
Thank you.
I'm actually starting a group this week of young women that lost their husband suddenly and have children. And so I plan to read sections of the book and suggest that they read it. I feel that your words can really help a lot of people that are floundering a little bit because they feel that they're not doing it the right way. But what you're really saying is you just go inside.
Right.
And that's what guided you.
Right.
One thing that struck me, Beth, about both the short film and your book was that, and I would love for you to expand on this more yourself, but I noticed, especially when I was watching the short film, of like, you mentioned in your book about the gifts that you got once Steve passed and the kind of, you know, the joys and the pleasures and the new awakenings and the new you. And you saw that in the film as well. Mm-hmm. And I think
in a different way,
for sure. But like the same kind of themes. And I think like we're trained to think if we have an experience loss that if you lose somebody that you love, you're going to be sad forever in this and only sad. Right. And if you lose someone and you didn't have a good relationship, then you'll feel relieved and you get to start anew. And there's this binary about how that's supposed to look. And it's not true. Right. And there's so many different ways to move on and live in the face of an incredible and seemingly insurmountable loss. And I think it's important. I think you've done a great job in both the book and with the short film in kind of really exploring the nuances and the different ways that grief can take shape, but also joy can take shape. And that isn't a reflection of what your relationship was with the person before. Right. Like, you know what I mean? Feeling joy after someone's passing doesn't mean that you didn't have a good relationship and now you're happy to be away from them. Quite the right. opposite often. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think it's really quite important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny because I'm just remembering a conversation that I had with a friend months after the funeral. And she said, I thought you were crazy because she said, I thought you lost it. She said, crazy because she saw me smiling and like through and like this whole, she said, you seemed euphoric. And I thought, oh my gosh, she's completely in shock. I mean, which I was, but the funny or not the funny thing. I mean, the interesting thing was, I mean, to me and also to anyone who knew Steve, especially our children as well, but all of our family and friends and people whose lives he touched, was this was a man who was filled with joy. Mm. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, he didn't have other aspects too, but he was really joyful. And his biggest desire was to make people happy. And that's, I mean, it's an incredible thing to say about someone. That is what he wanted, was to make people laugh, to make people happy and healthy and joyful. And the immediate thing that happened for all of the children, for our three children and for me, was we independently made a decision, which we then found out when we talked with each other, that the best thing we could do was to live in joy as a way of honoring Steve. And that decision helped us with our despair, because it's been real despair. Our kid, the children had an amazing father who they miss a lot, but this decision, so they always would go back to joy, which is an amazing force. And so that's a choice, is an inner choice. But I lost where I was going with this. I was going somewhere. It was building on what Bobby was saying.
No worries at all. I mean, that's the thing.
It was about the funeral. Oh, the funeral.
Yeah,
it was
about
the funeral and the birds. So So you had asked me earlier how the presence and absence thing. And so I felt at the funeral, what happened at the funeral for me was I felt very, very connected with Steve in an extraordinary way. And in a real way. And so I felt that we were, I had a friend of ours who was the piano player at the funeral. He played Cheek to Cheek, which was the song that we had danced to at our wedding. Mm-hmm. And it's funny in retrospect. I said, oh yeah, Rob, you have to play Cheek to Cheek. And he says, it's not really at the funeral. He's like, I have to figure out how to do that. And I mean, I remember the rabbis at our house saying, you know, what is the liturgy that you want? Like, what are the prayers that move Steve? And I said, well, yeah, he always liked the services and things, but really it's more like Irving Berlin and Gershwin and things. And I really want Cheek to Cheek to be played. And so my friend Rob, he said, I mean, I spoke with him years later. He's like, wow, that was, you know, having to play it in a way.
Yeah. But, it's very cinematic.
Right.
So it's wonderful.
He played, it was beautiful. And I felt, and I wrote this because I'm pretty confident I wasn't singing, because someone would have, my mother probably would have mentioned, why were you singing? But but I felt like I was singing when the song was playing. And then I was absolutely transported to a very, very beautiful place, mm-hmm. a happy place. Mm-hmm. And then at the cemetery, the grave site, there was this experience of unbelievable transcendence, a gift where after the burial, the rabbis had the mourners make two lines, and it created a path. There were hundreds of people at this funeral. I mean, there were like a and I know this only because it was the high holidays. And so we had set the temple up for extra seating. And so it was an overflow. So that's how come I know. It's not like I was counting. Yeah. But there were a lot of people there. And then even at the gravesite, there were hundreds of people. So it was a very long pathway. And we all had to walk. We walked through this pathway. And it was overwhelming initially when I saw all of these people, and everyone's feeling such pain and also incredible compassion and love for all of us and sorrow and all of that. And then as soon as I stepped into this pathway, it was really quite, surreal is the only word, but it was this, I felt the energy from the love that was coming from the mourners, as something that was visceral. And then when we were halfway through, Steve was a pilot of small planes, and his friends from the airport did a flyover. Wow. And so someone said, oh, the planes. I just was thinking of that TV show suddenly. The plane. I can't even think what it was. But anyway, we looked up, and then there was a red-tailed hawk that appeared suddenly, and it was flying with the planes in formation, which is, I said, it's not a hawk-like thing. Hawks don't usually fly in formation with planes. I mean, they fly, but, and everyone saw the hawk, and people who didn't believe in any sort of transcendent existence, we all saw it. It was amazing. And that this, and I felt myself again lifted up. It was like a column, and I was with Steve and held by him. And again, it was this feeling of joy, which worried my friend when she saw me smiling. But it was joy there, because these are things that are beyond, these are beyond the intellect. That's why I love Keats so much, for example. Not to sort of keep, but why not? I mean, he was 24 years old when he died, and he had unbelievable death in his life. His mother, his father, his brother, tuberculosis was the scourge of the time. And then he knew he was dying, and he had no money, and he wasn't recognized by more than just a few friends. But he was able to experience this joy in a palpable way by somehow receiving it and letting it lift him.
Yeah. Talking about poetry, we actually read this on another show, but it fits. I happen to love Mary Oliver. And I just find so much in Mary Oliver. So she says this. She says, "We shake with joy. We shake with joy. We shake with grief. What a time they have, these two, housed as they are in the same body." That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Totally.
The preciousness of joy, right? Like, I realized that this week because I've happened to be in a period of feeling really joyful. And I think, you know, after a year like this, you maybe even realize it more. But joy is so precious. It's so, like, it's like gold, you know? It's, and like, some of us are lucky to have more of it, and maybe more rich with it, and some aren't. But like, we all, and I shouldn't say we all, many of us get tastes of it throughout our lives. And I think as I personally get older and more conscious and have accrued more loss and more difficult times in my life, like that feeling, that like warm ray of joy, it's like when the...
Right.
It feels like when after the winter, the first time that you sit in the sun and it feels warm on your skin, like that to me is what joy is. And when you see that, like, take off your coat and just like bask in that for as long as it shines, you know? And I think like, especially when you've experienced loss, though, there can be this like fear that like, oh my God, but the sun's going to go down in an hour. And then, but like, fuck it. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter.
Well, that's where being in the moment helps us. That's where really bringing yourself back to the moment, not so much in the past, not in the future, knowing the difference and being in that moment. I always have this thing I call the string of pearls theory. And it's that we tend to think that all the pearls are going to be strung together. And that's life. And we're going to have this beautiful strung together. But it's not. There's a pearl under the couch, and there's a pearl under the bush, and there's a pearl. And we have to find them. And we string them together in a way in our belief system, in our philosophy of life. Right. Because like you say, Zara, they're not always, but when they're there. But it brings me to something else you spoke about, was the oyster, the metaphor of the oyster.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I thought that was wonderful because we know that it's the, what did you call it, the grief as an irritant.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And that's what makes the pearl in the oyster, right, is the right. irritant.
Oh, it's so right. beautiful. I love it so much.
Yeah.
You are the queen of metaphors. I mean,
I love you metaphors. You are a metaphorist. For two metaphor I'll be honest, lovers.
I'll be honest, I use them to help people. It's the only language. It's the language that I can speak because, again, it's universal. It's
right.
It's something that's throughout the ages. And unfortunately, I was reading it online. I need a book. And when I get your book, I'm going to be just like, woo, woo, woo. Because those metaphors help us understand life. It's just...
Sure. Because what they do is they invite... the other into the experience without telling them what to feel. So without giving that's really what it is. That's why poetry is so extraordinary, or literature can be so extraordinary, because you're not prescribing what other people need to make of an experience. You're trying to give images that then they can wrestle with. Absolutely. And come up with. Yeah.
Thank you. That really helped me understand the importance of that.
Yeah. I just recently finished reading the new Mike Nichols biography, A Life. And it's interesting because they talk a lot about that's how he directed. And, you know, Mike Nichols, such a prolific director of both stage and screen, and incredible artist and orator. And people would always say that he directed by metaphor instead of being like, hey, I want you to, like, you know, be more angry here. He would tell a story or give a metaphor and allow the actors to find their way in interpreting whatever that story or metaphor meant. And people would be like, oftentimes it would start off as you thought he was just telling you a story about him and Jack Nicholson, you know, getting drunk. And, but really it ended up being like a really deep metaphor. You'd find yourself somewhere in the story. And I think, you know, it's so important because as human beings, I think if someone's like, you have to watch this movie. This movie's great. I mean, sometimes you'll be like, oh, okay, I got to watch the movie. But I think coming to things on your own because you've seen flashes of it, like, oh, I saw a trailer for this movie and I discovered it and I want to watch it. You know, there has to be
as
some
a teacher,
kind of
that
autonomy
must be, as
in
a teacher,
it.
That must be the whole point of
exactly.
teaching, to invite. As you
exactly.
said.
That's what, exactly what I was just thinking of. I mean, the worst thing I could do is to reduce what I'm teaching to some sort of, this is what this means. Right. So when I teach Dante's Inferno, which I do, which is like every cool. September I seem to do that. Anyway, it's a weird thing. But I do that with the 11th grade. It's a tradition at this point. Mm. But, you know, inviting them to have, what does that mean? Right. And so Dante is writing on multiple levels. It's a very medieval kind of approach to literature anyway. It's like you're reading or experiencing things on multiple levels at the same time. It's literally, allegorically, a spiritual meaning and a metaphor. That all of that is part of it. And that's the way medieval writers thought. I mean, which is a little wild. How do you think? But that's also, for me, that's what grief it requires, right? Is like being present on these multiple levels at one time, which is...
Your book does that really well, because that's exactly what the book does. It's not just a narrative.
Oh, good.
It's multiple levels. I read it quickly too. You know, I work all week and I can't wait to take it and really digest it in a different way.
Did you like my visit from Walt Whitman? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
I felt like people who are very literal said, wait, did you really? Wait.
But then again, that's your inner world. And I wanted to ask you about one other thing, which I think is really important in grief, which has to do with the imaginal relationship with the beloved.
Uh-huh.
And can you tell us more? Because I think you used those words, or maybe it was my word to describe what you were saying, but talking to Steve.
Right.
You know, feeling him talk to you.
Right.
Do it with being in the woods and feeling that he's with you.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
how did that help you in your grief to have that imaginal relationship?
I still have it. I mean, I still journal, and I find myself at different times just talking to him in my journal. So it brings him it brings him close to me. Mm-hmm. And then if I, people can conclude as they wish, but if I'm being authentic to the experience, I'm then able to hear him. And mm-hmm. so for me, that is tremendous comfort. And the thing that I've discovered is that if I don't, and this was more true in the first few years, but it's still true. If I don't take an hour in the morning before I go off and start my day to journal and to to sort of listen to myself, but also in those days to really be with Steve, I would be off the whole day. Like if I couldn't create that conversation with him. So it became another lifeline.
Yeah. That's actually advice in a way to help other people if they, reminds me again of a Rumi quote, which I love this one.
Yeah.
He said, "Now that you live here in my heart, everywhere is a mountaintop."
That's beautiful. Yeah, I love Rumi too. I was big into poetry. I still am, actually. Yeah.
Good thing to be big into. I do that with my dad too. I continue the relationship with my dad, and I talk to him all the time. And I'm a chef, so when I'm cooking things, particularly when I'm baking things, I'll talk to him out loud. I'll be like, "You would love this," or like, "What should I do here?" And it is helpful, and it is like, I mean, I don't know. I think we have to find these ways to keep people around. And
that's definitely
in grief work, they call it continuing bonds. And it's a wonderful word, you know, the way we do that, whether it's wearing a talisman, you know, something that you wear, my mother's necklace that I will always wear forever and never take off, you know, or whether it's, and part of what our show is about is that sometimes food becomes that way of continuing bonds.
Right.
So I wonder in your family, is there any way that surrounding food and sprouting, obviously your son's continuing the business is one way of continuing bonds, but are there any things around food that bring you together and bring you closer to Steve?
Yes. Very, very strongly. So our youngest son is still living at home and is an amazing chef. Steve was an amazing chef. Noah is an amazing chef. And I have the gift. I'm not an amazing chef. I mean, I can do okay, but it's an art, and I'm not that kind of an artist, and for whatever reason, but Noah is. And so his food preparation is very much, it's very much brings Steve in a real way into our life. And I'm always having sprouts growing, and I never sprouted. I was not the sprouter. I have them growing in the kitchen, and I'm eating them. So, and I feel him very present in that way. And I think, and then our son, Ari, who runs the business with Noah, he's actively sprouting for the business and doing experiments. So he's taken that on. And our daughter is very much living in this, trying to live this raw food life that her father taught her. So, yeah, we're all, I mean, he's the food is a huge part. And when I say that in the book, I think I use the terms that he fed me but I think Steve fed me in just so many ways. He was older than me, almost 11 years older, and he taught me so much. And he also just created a space where I could step into who I am. And I think I'm constantly struck by the fact that, I mean, this is where we started the conversation, but that I, as a young girl, wanted to be a writer and an actress, neither of which I did. My entire life with Steve, it was like our life together was living in the Berkshires and me being a teacher and raising three children and with him and all of that. But he died. And then suddenly it's like, I'm picking up again these fundamental parts of myself that I didn't know were still there.
Right. Who am I now?
Yeah. That's why I just realized at the end that as I was writing the book, I mean, my intention in writing the book was to honor Steve and to like give everybody a picture, to somehow create something that would recognize who he was. And then that the surprise of the whole thing one of the surprises was that it had to be about me. And I had to become the hero of my own life, which is what I'm, right. where I'm at. I'm on that journey. I'm not, it's not over yet, but that's where I'm working.
Totally.
That was another thing that struck us about, you know, the hero's journey.
Yeah.
And the metaphor of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually read the real hero's journey, which I'm sure that you're aware of as uh-huh. it's, you know, the kind of the arc and the structure mm-hmm. for any script or most right. fiction. But for our listeners who might not know about the hero's journey, or it can be called a story circle, I just uh-huh. want to read it to people because I think it's applicable to you, and you can tell us. But there's a lot of different mm-hmm. versions of the hero's journey story circle, which you can look up online. But this mm-hmm. is kind of the basic one, which is part one is a call to adventure. And it begins as phase one, the ordinary world, the call to adventure, and then the refusal. Then in part two, it's the supreme ordeal or the initiation. And there's a mentor or helper, crossing the threshold, tests, allies, and enemies. Then you enter phase three, which is the transformation. And you have the approach, the ordeal, death slash rebirth, the treasure. And then in part four, the road back to the slash the hero's return, there's the road back, there's atonement and growth, and then finally reward. And I just think that's interesting. When Bobby and I were talking earlier about the hero's journey, I was like, oh, it would be a good thing to read that. I think I might have read it before on the show, but I'm actually writing a short film myself. And in that, I started discovering the story circle, and I was like, oh, this is perfect. It's so applicable to,
right.
to life right. and people's struggles. But Beth, we are nearing the end of our talk, sadly, because we could sit here and talk to you all day. This has been absolutely incredible and so fun and lovely and I feel spirited. Like I've learned so much. Thank highly you. Spirited. Yeah. yeah. So at the end of each show, we ask everybody the same thing. And that is, if you could have given yourself if you could give yourself now at the beginning, your former self at the beginning of this grief journey for you, one piece of advice, knowing what you know now and what you've been through, do you have some advice for your former self?
That's a hard question. But I think, I don't know. I just keep thinking that it's okay. Mm. And also, this is more than just one sentence, but
yeah.
You had mentioned earlier about, relationships and when people lose people that they love, they might have regrets or have feelings of guilt about the imperfect nature of the relationship, of which I've got plenty of. Mm. I mean, this was not sunshine and light for 30 yeah. years, but ultimately the love is what lasts. Maybe that's more the advice. The love is a real force. The love lasts. And at the end of it, that's what matters. That's really all that matters mm. because we do the best we can when we're alive and mm. we do the best we can with what we have. So mm. I guess it's really that. It's more love. Love is the mm. thing. Hang on to mm-hmm. love. Yeah.
Amen. Beautiful. And Bobby.
We have one other part of our program, which is if we could have a meal together now, which I wish we could. It would be breakfast because it's early, because morning. But it would be nice to think, what would we all bring to our feast together?
Oh.
So I have my idea, which is that it's a little early for this, but I would bring a grapefruit cocktail. Fresh grapefruit yeah. cocktail.
Oh.
Love that. Bobby, you are already looking to start the party, but I love that for you and for okay.
Good.
Okay, I'll go. I love sprouts and I love sprouting things, and I kind of learned about it during my time at my former restaurant that I had. My sous chef and I kind of really got into sprouting different things, and we started sprouting wheat berries, which was really fun. I didn't even know you could do that.
Oh yeah.
And so I would bring a sprouted wheat berry salad with kind of a delicious sesame, kind of maybe like sesame honey dressing, a little apple cider vinegar, some pistachios, lots of fresh herbs, cucumber.
Oh, wow.
Ground up cheddar cheese.
Okay, I'm rethinking now. So after talking about sprouts and healthy eating, I happen to love pasta. So I was thinking, so separate from Steve and I were perfect. Different in that way. But I think what I would bring to go along with what you have, I think it doesn't exactly go, but I just suddenly felt like having some sort of delicious cheese and bread platter. Some amazing cheeses, brie, goat cheeses. There's a lot of nice goat farms up here. And,
oh my God.
Bring that. And
we visit one of them. We actually go, what's the goat farm?
Monterey goat cheese farm. Yeah. Is it Rawson Goat Farm?
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So please bring some of that. Include that in your. I'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Special request. Yeah. Ooh, that sounds great. And there's a great cheese shop up there in Great Barrington, too, that we love. Rubiner's.
Oh, my gosh. Fabulous. Incredible. Yeah, well, we can get the cheese from there. And then
I'll bring the cheese from there.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay, and Zara, you can bring the bread from Brooklyn.
Okay, I'll bake some bread. I'll make some sourdough focaccia. And it'll be good.
You make bread.
Oh, yeah. I make bread. I make focaccia. I've been making a lot of sourdough focaccia. So I just was recently doing a pop-up all winter, an Italian-American pop-up called Zaza Lasagna. So I have been in full-on pasta, focaccia, like all the kind of like delicious things. That's why I'm like, I'll bring some of those sprouts. But I'll always eat pasta. Don't get me wrong.
That's great.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
You're such a warm human being. And you seem to have integrated this unbelievable tragedy. It's just a part of you.
Yeah.
And makes you even richer, right?
Yeah, I guess. Thank you.
Really, really wonderful to talk to you. And just to mention again, I just want you to let people know, I will mention A Grief Sublime is the book. Incredible book. We can't recommend it enough. Sproutland is the short film, which you can, where can we find Sproutland? How do we get that?
So it's sproutlandfilm.com is the website, the film website. It's right now making the rounds of the film festivals. So it's not widely available, but you can watch it through the Florida Film Festival. But my website, which is my name, Beth Robbins Writer, .com has all the info and the book. But if you put in the book name, it'll take you eventually to me, or pretty quickly to me. So
I watched it yesterday and bought like a pack of short films, and there were some other great shorts in
there
too.
Right, there are.
That's like a cool thing too. I love short films. I think it's such an interesting kind of medium because you're asked to do what you would do in a feature, but in a shorter amount of time, which seems like at first like, oh, it's just a short film. But the challenge of making a compelling short film is really difficult. Really difficult. And really, it's a cool way to make films. So, and yours was great. And you're a great actress. And I loved seeing you. And I was like, oh my gosh, Beth is amazing. So it was beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I really loved it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Beth, thank you so much for this.
When we're up in the Berkshires, can we look you up?
Oh, please do. I feel like we have to see each other. And I really want this food that we've been talking about.
Okay, great. Well,
so this is good. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Beth. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay. Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company specializing in creative digital video, photography, and podcast production. From concept through post-production, Hot Dish creates and produces compelling food stories that ignite the chef in all. Hot Dish Productions has deep connections to award-winning and celebrity chefs and over 20 years' experience. Their team has won both a James Beard Award and an IACP Award for their work in food media. Hot Dish Productions delivers the highest quality product at a fair value. Let them help tell your culinary story today. Explore their work and learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.